Hello, welcome to the Data Science Salon podcast. I'm your host, Q McCallum, AI consultant, writer, and senior content advisor at Formulated By, which is the company behind this podcast. If you've been in the data game long enough, you've probably seen this before. A stakeholder or product owner approaches you with a project that's almost done, and they'd like you to sprinkle some AI on it. You see, they've heard that this AI thing can be useful, and so they want some of it in their latest effort. Now, Noelle Saldana is my favorite data scientist turned product person, and she's experienced the sprinkle some AI on it request more times than she'd care to remember. So I caught up with Noelle shortly after her talk at the Data Council conference to explore this phenomenon. We cover topics such as how this even happens, and here's a hint, it's corporate FOMO, or fear of missing out. What should you do when stakeholders insist on implementing AI that isn't actually going to help anything? Also, what about when your data scientist peers seem like they're doing this all for the sake of what I like to call resume-driven development? Ultimately, we work through the bigger issue, which is, how do you make peace with companies throwing money at AI like this? And how can these companies use this approach to their advantage? As a bonus, Noelle shares how she made the move from a data scientist role into product management. If this path sounds interesting to you, then take a listen. And with that, let's get started. Noelle, welcome in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I know we've known each other for a long time. My audience doesn't know you that well yet, unless they've checked the show notes. So maybe you can take a couple of minutes to tell us, who is Noelle, what do you do, and what brings you to the show today?
Thanks, Q. So my name is Noelle. I've been a data scientist I've been a math nerd for much longer, my whole life. But I started my career as a data scientist about 15 years ago, and I have grown in that journey to leading various data science teams, as well as making a move into product, because I was really curious to see if I could help prevent some of the data problems that we deal with day in and day out before they started, and really getting the heart of fixing problems, you know, rather than with just data science, but fixing them more holistically, like figuring out what all those solutions are. In my experience, I worked with companies everywhere from small startups to the Fortune 500, people who had petabytes of data, and then people whose data didn't even exist yet. And so it's been a really fun journey to see, especially when I started the data science, wasn't really a thing yet. So it's just a math nerd trying to navigate a 2008 world to where it is now, you know, where AI is so ubiquitous and really at the forefront of what a lot of the innovation that we're seeing today.
So given that, let's dig in a bit. As you mentioned, you started off studying math. You have, I believe, a couple of degrees in math. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And data science wasn't really a job yet. Like you said, it was 2008. That's right on the cusp of when data science was becoming a thing. But what that means is that clearly, young Noelle didn't grow up dreaming of being a data scientist someday. So how did you go from getting your first math degree to your second math degree to data science? What was your path?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I wanted to be a doctor when I was getting my first math degree, like I think all Asian kids do at some point. And, you know, it was an interesting journey. I think after I decided not to become a doctor, I really then explored what is it I could do with a math degree. And it turns out that getting another math degree was the next obvious step. But in doing that, you know, I saw multiple paths, which were get yet another math degree or go into the industry or teach. Those were the three options. And I explored all three of those things. I did at the time. And it was because I'm an applied mathematician, I decided to figure out how I can go apply mathematics. And went to the industry. I got an internship at what was MySpace, owned by Fox at the time. I promise it was a thing for people who didn't live in a free TikTok world. You know, somebody had found out that I was an intern and had a degree in math and said, hey, there's this group that's doing research analytics. They do math there. It's part of a, you know, advanced R&D group that's doing machine learning. You should look into it. And I had an introduction internally, and that's how I got started, long story short. And so it was kind of being at the right place at the right time, and having at that point, having both a math degree and having a little bit of experience now in real world programming helped me in that journey. So it's so funny when people ask me, especially 10 years ago when data science was really beginning to hype, like, how did you know that this was going to be the next thing? And how did you prepare for that? How did you, like, I got lucky, you know, as a mathematician, I could have easily just been a researcher in a basement somewhere for the rest of my career, just doing math that nobody else saw, or, you know, the career that I've had instead, which has been, you know, really phenomenal. I'm just so grateful, you know, had been given those opportunities early in my career.
What you said there about the amount of luck that went into this happening, I can definitely see that. And I think a lot of people in this field can say the same thing. In fact, it reminds me of the early days of my career during the tail end of the dot-com era, aka the start of the dot-com bust, if you will. And it was the same thing. I would run into people from all kinds of fields, everything from aerospace engineering to people who were doing their PhD in physics to whatever, and they ended up having to write software or manage systems to run the code for their simulations. Met a few people who had come from construction and the arts world as well, just people coming in from all over. And it's interesting to hear your path to this field, because you're right. A lot of us sort of fell into this because this job didn't exist at the time. And another role that wasn't really as well known was this notion of product and product management, which is another step you've taken in your career. So a lot of data scientists, or a lot of people in the data sphere in general, well, in the early days, they went one of two paths. Either one, as their career progressed, they would dig deeper into the technological side of things and get deeper and deeper into specific tech stacks or techniques. Or they might say, you know, I'm looking for something a little higher level. I would like to lead a team. And so they break away from that individual contributor or IC path, and they head down the road of management and leadership titles. And then this product thing came along. And what I find interesting about that is I've met a handful of data science practitioners who went down that product path. And I have a couple of stories behind why, but I'd love to hear yours. So you go from math degree one, math degree two, data science, and then product. How did that last step happen?
Oh, that evolution, I think, happened because of the evolution of data science as well. But over time, it evolved into not just, hey, we need a data scientist to go spin gold out of the data that we have. Rather, it was, we are building things that need a data science component to them. We're trying to build an app that has a recommendation engine in it. We're trying to build something that uses predictions. We want numbers to be displayed on a thing. And so the data science bit started to be part of a much larger thing. It was so fascinating to me to see that, because it meant that the so what of what we were doing with all of those models was the decisions that people were making, how it was affecting their businesses, how it was affecting their customers' lives and decisions. And the problems that we're ultimately solving wasn't just, how do we make this model better? How do we get the best fit model? But what is that in service of? And for me, I wanted to be more part of that conversation, zooming out a little bit and realizing that the data science piece can be one puzzle piece of a whole solution to me was what motivated me into going into product, because I thought that there were just more interesting problems that could be solved and more tools that you could use to do that. The second part, which I alluded to earlier in the intro, was that when data science is a small piece of that bigger puzzle, and we can talk about this, later, but when it's a part of that bigger puzzle, it is reliant on some of those other pieces to be successful, right? Like data science can't exist if there's no data to science upon. And I've said that a lot. And so, but in order for the data to exist, in order for it to be salient, in order for it to be useful for any of those things and make any of those things possible downstream, it has to be thought of ahead of time. It has to be curated. And that decision process happens as part of the product.
If I can put some words in your mouth, it's almost as though what you're saying is that you saw a bit of a gap that you could fill inside these companies, which was these companies, they have data scientists who understand the technical side of the picture very well. And you have stakeholders who understand the business side very well. But it's almost as though they needed someone who could bridge those two worlds and who could say, yes, I understand the technology side, but I also want to help the stakeholders understand what it is we're trying to build and how AI and data science and machine learning actually fit into this so we can become successful in what we're trying to build. Would you say that I've captured that well?
Yeah, for sure. And I find that interpretation piece, first of all, missing in a lot of places, but also really fun. So there's a full circle that I see is that a stakeholder comes in, the business comes in, and they say, like, we have a problem with churn, or we have a problem with whatever it is. They don't go to a data scientist and say, hey, data scientist, I need a neural network. Like, what they do is they say, hey, data scientist, we have a problem with churn, right? And so somebody has to make that call. Somebody's job is to speak both those languages and say, stakeholder, these are the business problems that you see. There's a way to solve this with mathematics. There's a way to solve this with AI. There's a way to solve this with data. Hey, data team, the problem I need you to solve is this, right? And that interpretation to what that is. And it's not, let me load you with all of the financial reasons that we need to solve this problem. This is what you need to know. We're trying to solve this. Go make the best model that you can. And then once they make the best model that they can, then there's that last piece of like, okay, great. You got an accuracy of whatever it was, or you got a model that can be refreshed at this rate or learns at this rate. What does that mean for the business? You're not going to walk back to your executive and say, like, look at my results of this model, or like, anybody want to look at my ROC curve? Like, no, you shouldn't do that. Don't walk into an exec meeting with like an ROC curve. But instead, it's, we made this model. This is the impact to the business. And so that critical piece that you said, like the sitting in the middle of that layer of being able to interpret back and forth, is that critical missing piece. And that could be different depending on the organization that you're in.
I'd really like to learn a little bit more about your move from data science IC practitioner into product. You've described what interested you about that move, and that makes a lot of sense. But as far as your employer or employers at the time when you were making this transition, did they also see this potential, or did you feel that you were fighting upstream a bit, trying to make them understand, trying to help them to see that there was value in having someone in this role to bridge the gap between the different parties and the organization?
That's a good question. I deliberately took my time trying to find that role because, to your point, there aren't a lot of organizations that, one, acknowledge that that's something that they needed, and two, would buy into it. And so it was really the perfect opportunity came along that allowed me to do that, because they had said specifically, we want someone to own data, but from a product standpoint. They wanted to sit in product. We want to use the results of this data specifically for product decisions. We want to invest in this person. And so that's what led me to that role, because I think it's easy to fall into a trap of being hired for one thing, but being asked to do another when you land and you get there. And that happens a lot, I think, with data scientists, is that you go to an organization thinking that you're going to do one thing, thinking that you're going to do machine learning, thinking that you're going to do really whatever it is. And it's typically something that you think is at the forefront of the technology. And you go to an organization and you find, they don't have data set up. They don't have reporting set up. They don't have all of these things that you need to do first before you get to AI done. And that happens all the time. You see this in organizations. And so for me, knowing that this, the organization I even joined had all of those things in place and specifically said, this person is going to sit in the product organization because these are the pain points that they identified to me during the interview process. These were the issues that we have that we want to fix, you know, and we're all in, this is what we want to do. That was really the turning point or the convincing point for me.
Clearly, you were very strategic about this migration, which is how you operate. I have a few more questions for you about that later on. I think as we wrap up, I suspect some listeners would love to learn more about thoughts you might have for a data scientist who would like to move into a product role. But we'll try to cover that at the end if we have more time. What I'd like to do right now is shift gears for a second and get to the heart of what we're going to talk about today. And so the way this works is that Noelle and I, we keep in touch on a fairly regular basis. A couple of months ago, she pinged me to get some feedback on a talk she was putting together. And after she gave me the rundown, I said, I absolutely love this idea, but I also followed up with, I love this idea because I'm biased. And I sent her a screen cap of a blog post I was working on that was for roughly the same topic. You know, we were taking slightly different angles on it, but the core theme was the same. Noelle and I did what any other people would have done in that situation, is that we gave each other a ton of feedback, we swapped ideas, and so on and so forth, and here we are. I will post a link to Noelle's conference from the Data Council conference in the show notes, and I'll also link to my blog post in the end. Point being, Noelle, first things first, thank you so much for all of your feedback. That was a much better blog post as a result.
Oh, thank you for your feedback. My talk certainly wouldn't have been the same without your feedback as well.
You're very kind. And all that leads us to what we're talking about today. And it's funny because a minute ago you talked about how it's very rare that a stakeholder goes to a data scientist and says, I want a neural network. And I was going to make a crack, which was they usually don't, but when they do, that's a different sort of bad sign. And that gets to what we're going to talk about today and what you and I covered in your conference talk in my blog post, is that there is something that happens in a lot of companies, and I suspect a lot of our listeners will either nod or sigh, or maybe just sort of hang their head when they hear me say this, is that someone in the organization decides that there is some problem that the company faces, and they're just going to sprinkle some AI on it, as though AI is this kind of magic fairy dust that's going to solve all of the problems. And so you talked about that in your conference talk. I think this is a good opportunity for me, without you giving away the full talk that you gave at Data Council, but this is a chance for me to ask you more about what was in that talk and why you think this is an issue and so on and so forth. So I think first things first, when we talk about this idea of sprinkle some AI on it, what is that really and how does that happen?
So there is so much hype around AI right now. And it is, I imagine, the top of so many executives' minds, that they see that all of these companies out here are innovating and they have new AI features coming out every day. And in order for people to be competitive in whatever space that they're in, that's what they have to do next. If they're not doing that, they're behind. I assume we're seeing this everywhere, because you and I certainly have for the past 10 years, if not more, where you have people start asking, oh, can you just add some extra sparkly stuff to this? Can you just make this a little smarter? The frustration, there's so much frustration around being asked to do that. And that's really what the genesis of my talk was, is, you know, gosh, people really don't understand what that means when they ask to do that. When they ask the practitioners, can you just add a little AI to it? Can you just sprinkle some on? Lots of problems with asking that. And also, not just asking, but then trying to do that is also really, really hard for lots of different reasons. We've seen this forever. And so I remember when, I'd say 10 years ago, sentiment analysis was the new big thing. And like everyone who had a consumer product thought, oh, like people are doing great things with Twitter right now. Like, what are people doing with, or on social media? People are mentioning products on social media. Let's just scrape the internet. Scraping the internet was very trendy, where people would say, you know, they were augmenting not just what they could get internally from their products. They were starting to look outside, like, oh, people are saying things about my product elsewhere. out there on the internet. And if I could just know what people were saying or about my product or even my competitor's product, oh, that's also out there in the internet. I could buy that competitive intel because it's out there on the internet. It was so trendy that everyone was doing it, you know, that everybody wanted to do this as part of like whatever their next internal or external product was like. But there's lots of problems with that. One being the size of the internet, but two, also how much people are actually talking about whatever esoteric product you're working on. And so while there are some things that sure will get a lot of mention, when every single corporate company is out there asking for this, you have to wonder, like, is there really going to be enough data for people to do this? Like, the reality is probably not. And so assume we're going to continue seeing these trends. You know, whatever, people will see the popular AI model and say, oh, well, that's the thing. Why can't I do that? And sure, maybe you should do that, but it doesn't mean everyone can and everyone, and it will be profitable or useful for everyone. But not everyone knows that, right? So back to the point, like, but why? You're being asked to add a little whatever to your product, and it's not because it's fulfilling a specific need or a pain point that your company has or even your stakeholder has. It's just corporate FOMO.
You and I can make fun of this right now because we work in the field. We can see you from afar. This is silly. That is clearly not going to help you. You know, there is no reason for you to try to shove AI into, oh, I don't know, some sort of deodorant or something or other, but like, it's fine. You and I can laugh at this. We're grabbing drinks. We can talk about this, but let's talk about what this means inside of a company where they're feeling this corporate FOMO. So let's say you are an AI practitioner inside a company that's fallen for the corporate FOMO for AI. They're trying to just sprinkle AI onto this. Why is it a big deal for them?
I think I felt this frustration first and foremost as a practitioner. When you're being asked, it feels like you're being asked to do the impossible. First of all, there is no just sprinkling anything AI related onto something. You know, as much as we may be sold at how easy it is to add things to products now, like, certainly that's not really the case. And I think that is not setting people up for success. And they know that. If you get called in as a practitioner and be told, like, we just need you to add a little something to this. And you know, in your first reaction, your heart of hearts, like, I can't just add, like, you're asking me to deliver months and months of work to just add on top of this thing. From the get-go, you know, as a practitioner that that's impossible. And that whatever you do is going to be disappointing to your stakeholders. No matter what, like, even just saying from the get-go, like, I can't deliver that. I can't deliver this in the time that you're expecting, because you're expecting that I can just pull some magic trick out here when I know that it's far, far, far more work to do that. And no one wants to go and being the bad guy with, like, they don't. You don't want to feel like the bad guy, or you have one of two options in that case as a practitioner. You either go and say, no, I can't do that. And then you feel like the bad guy because you're the party pooper for dashing someone's AI dreams and what, you know, this really important stakeholder wants. Or you say yes, knowing that you can't actually deliver on it, and you're just delaying that pain till later, right? Or you try to do something really frantic, and it's frustrating the whole way down to do it.
Sure. But let's press on this for a second. I mean, to your point, let's pretend that you are J random data scientist in one of these companies, and some stakeholder is suffering some serious FOMO. They just figure that whatever it is you're building, it could be some sort of widget, some sort of SaaS application, something. They just feel, we need AI, and Noel, you're leading our data science efforts. Can you just add some AI for us? How do you handle that? Like, what sort of new strategies would a data scientist in that hot seat need to navigate that sort of minefield?
I think one thing that you should really get to in this scenario is what they expect the AI to do in that product or whatever it is that they're trying to deliver. Because it turns out also the miscommunication or perhaps the misalignment of expectations of what AI is is coming into play there, because if somebody is coming to you and say, like, I need an AI model, sprinkle some on, and you, well, the way that you're defining an AI model is like a really involved, deep thing, but what they really want doesn't need AI, or what they really want isn't that. You can help reset expectations, right? Like, sometimes people say they want AI, but they don't need AI, or they don't want AI. What they really want is a rules engine, or what they really want is something that will make the experience of the product better because it provides something and is surfacing up something. But that doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be a super, super complicated model, right? So I think trying to figure out what the expectations are and defining upfront what success looks like will help alleviate some of those pain points. Like, if you define that up front, first of all, if you don't define it up front, you are setting up yourself for failure. But to define success up front, what is it, stakeholder, that you want here? Like, what is it, stakeholder, that will make us look like we're succeeding? What is the end deliverable actually look like? And if that's still something that's impossible, if it's still something that you can't agree to, that's where you escalate. You escalate and just bring as many people as you can in, I guess, in that scenario to back you up, right? It's, you know, I think being very, ultimately, the data scientist there is the expert, is the technical expert, right? What are they going to do if you say, like, this is not feasible, right? This is not feasible. If you want to play the improv game, you can just say, like, this is not feasible right now, and in 3 months, and in 6 months, we could revisit it. You know, it needs to be a conversation that goes back and forth. And, you know, it's not just a straight yes or no answer in that scenario, but it is tough. It's very tough to manage those expectations.
Oh, it's definitely difficult. First of all, I really like your approach of bringing in other people to help lead your case, to build the case. That's a sharp move. I can also share a couple of tactics I've seen and one I've had to try myself on a few occasions. So, you know, because one question I was going to press on was, well, let's say that this exec just really, really wants AI. Like, you can tell that this just calls for a rules engine, but their view is, look, I need to meet my other CEO buddies somewhere. I need to tell them I'm doing AI. I need to tell them what I'm doing because they're going to call me out if it's not really AI. What do I do? And one thing I've seen, or at least one tip I've received, they have told me what they do is sometimes they will find a way to let the stakeholder or the executive have their AI, like real AI models in TensorFlow or whatever, but they cordon it off. So it's a project that involves AI somehow, but it's not really connected to the bottom line. It's not connected to any business processes that actually generate revenue or are responsible for interacting with customers or that sort of thing. And that way, the executive gets what they want. They get a piece of AI they can talk about with their CEO buddies and say, we're doing AI. The person in the technical leadership role gets to keep their job, which is not something we should forget here. And also, the business overall gets to avoid the disruption that comes with these big corporate FOMO projects as they come through. So that's one technique that I've seen work for people who are FTEs. And I know there are a number of listeners out there who are consultants in the AI world, as I am. Unfortunately, I've had to take a different approach. You know, sometimes I'm talking with a prospective client and they just really want AI in a way that does not make sense and it is not going to work. And let's face it, there are some less than scrupulous consulting firms out there that would take the business anyway and find some way to pretend they've actually delivered AI. That's not my style. My approach is to look at something and realize, I'm about to enter into a contractual relationship with this company to deliver something that is impossible. In that case, if they really want AI, and I feel that AI is not, it's one thing if it's just going to be silly, that's fine. But if they want AI that's not going to work or it's just not possible, in that case, I have to walk away. But I also realize that consultants, we're in a slightly different space in that we don't yet have that relationship, so we can end things right then and there. Whereas someone who is inside a company like the technical leaders I was talking about before, they have to, as I've framed it, they have to develop new strategies to handle stakeholder eagerness, if you will. So what else have you seen as far as handling that stakeholder eagerness when they just really, really, really want to have that AI?
It's interesting that you mention, you know, cordoning off a little piece of it, because sometimes the demoware is all they really need. Turns out, I think sharing small pieces or maybe intermediate steps and getting feedback from your stakeholders before you go and spend 3-4 months making some super, super polished thing is useful. What if what they want to see that it's possible with what they have, right? I mean, to be fair, you could also be setting yourself up for even more failure, because as soon as you give them a demo, they're like, this is great, put it everywhere. But, you know, I think showing that rough draft intermediate step will be enough at least to quench some of the FOMO up front. Don't kill yourself trying to deliver a demo in a short amount of time. But I think that there is something to be said about showing demoware, doing things. And in general, I'm a big fan of iterative processes and, you know, showing things when they're unpolished and getting feedback on them. And so that would be one step. Because what you don't want to happen is you spend 3 months, you're like, oh, very important stakeholder said they want X. We're going to make the very best model that does this as possible. And you go away for 3 months building that and desperately trying to do that. And you come back and it turns out they're like, oh, that's nice. That's cool. Don't really want this, it turns out. Or like, oh, I just wanted to play with it and see if we could do it. Or they just wanted to be able to check that box off to your earlier point to their CEO buddies, right? Like having real communication and making sure they're invested in it is so important, right? Like if they're not really vested in it, don't waste your time doing it. But if they, you know, come to those meetings and they're super excited and they give you feedback and maybe it is part of what they really want, but then you could start building that rapport and telling them what the risks are and telling them whether or not, you know, what the cost of building this thing is that is clearly their pet project.
So this is great. You know, we started this podcast talking about sprinkling AI on things, and the listeners are now getting strategies for how to work with their stakeholders and executives. This is the bonus that comes with the Data Science Salon podcast, and I'm here for it. But let's flip this around for a second here. So fine, that's how you handle your stakeholders and your executives who are just dead set on having the AI thing and sprinkling AI everywhere. But let's face it, there's another guilty party here. And that is sometimes our fellow data practitioners. And there are some people who they are in the data field because they like working with these tools and techniques. They want to learn more. And for them, they're just excited about the prospect of being able to do something with it in the workplace. So what happens when this corporate FOMO doesn't so much come from the top of the org chart, but for one of your peers side to side? What do you do then?
You know, there's a phrase I like using sometimes, which is not my circus, not my monkeys. And depending on the situation, it depends whether or not you should get involved or not. Every data scientist is stylistic. We all, and this is true. If you've worked with a lot of data scientists, which I have for my career, everybody has specific styles to how they do things in terms of, it's kind of like art, you know, in terms of the kinds of algorithms they pick, how they make choices about the features that they build, the kinds of data cleaning they like to do, what tools they like to use, what algorithms they like to pick. Everyone has a style, right? And it's not saying that any is necessarily right or wrong in that style, right? However, right, there are, because of that style, there are data scientists that you notice like, wow, every single one of your projects uses whatever algorithm it is. Like, you know, everybody knows. So maybe you're that person. Maybe you're that person that everything you use has like very specific. And again, there may not be anything wrong with doing that. Like, if you really, really like this specific class of algorithm and it works for the projects you're working on, great. Where this becomes problematic is if you are choosing to use algorithms for the sake of choosing them, or using them because you want to practice using them at the detriment of your stakeholder, at the detriment of the overall results, right? And so again, not to play the stay in your lane card, but where it matters, right? Where If it's a matter of just style, pick your fights. I don't think that's a hill you necessarily need to die on. But if you do see that, if, hey, this person is just picking these algorithms just to pick these algorithms, it's where peer reviews and demos and knowledge sharing is a really powerful thing to have in having teams, being able to give people feedback, very candid feedback. Like, hey, I see that you're using this. Can you tell me why you're not using this other instead? Can you help me understand? You come from a place from, help me understand why, you know, and to see if they're forthright about their choices.
That's a good way to address people engaging in what I like to call resume-driven development, where they'll pick whatever's the hot technology of the moment, so they can put it on their resume and maybe foist it onto their next employer. Not that I've ever seen anyone do that. Maybe this is a good time for us to play devil's advocate. Right? In other words, you know me, you've known me for a long time, and you've known for the long time that I'm that guy in AI, right? I'm the guy to look around the room and just say, hey, do we really need this here? Can we try this other thing? Why are we rushing into this? I'm asking all the questions that you're talking about right now, which is, why are we doing this? Can you explain this? So on and so forth. You know, all for the sake of making sure that the company is getting into the right spot at the right time and using the right tools to take them forward and all that sort of thing. But a few years ago, I sort of made my peace with all of the AI hype. I kind of figured that, look, all of the companies that are just flinging money at AI, they effectively comprise a public testing lab, right? What happens is they're throwing all this money at AI. They are showing us where AI could actually work. And they're also going to find out sometimes the hard way where it doesn't work. And they sort of form a public good at that point, because collectively, through their experimentation and through their budgets, we learn where AI fits and where it doesn't. And so there's the part of me that says, as long as we accept that companies are doing this, or I guess I should say, as long as we take the perspective that companies are treating this as just one big testing lab, is it really that bad that we're trying to shove AI into every place that it might fit? So in other words, can we play devil's advocate? And can we ask, when it comes to this idea of sprinkling AI on everything, is it really a problem?
There's a yes and no, right? There's a yes and no to all of these things. That is it really that bad? And, you know, as a math person, as a math geek at heart, who's kind of the positives, I'm excited that people know what it is. You know, like at the end of the day, you have people who would never be talking about AI previous to this, playing with something like a ChatGPT, having hands-on interaction and experience with a model, and can maybe even say something about the model. Right? It's not esoteric. We don't have just a handful of people in mathematicians in a basement, like I referred to before, who are touching all of the really cool things. And that is so exciting for me. And my hope for all of this too is, with the expansion of this, as more commonplace as all of these things are, we'll get more people involved in it. Like, we'll have kids who will realize that math is cool. We'll have more people who are underrepresented in tech going and studying all of these things and help shape everything involved in software and AI in the next generation. You know, think of how different a world they're growing up in, that everyone is talking about AI. Everyone is talking about software and development and data. We certainly didn't grow up into that. As you said, like, all of us now have all stumbled our way into it. There was no common path. We were all pioneering the ways that we got here. And we all kind of blinked and went, I guess we're here now. And it's going to be far more deliberate for people in the future. And that's cool to me.
Yeah, I think that's cool. And I like your point about the number of people who will start talking about AI right now. It's going to become part of their day-to-day. You know, something I've probably posted a few rants about this on LinkedIn or maybe my website or somewhere. I keep having this recurring thought, which is, in the short run, when it comes to emerging technology, right? In the short run, all the talk is about the technology itself and the tools and the techniques and the practitioners. And I think that's great. But over time, that new technology starts to interact with the real world, right? It starts to bump into institutions and even laws that were designed without it in mind. And so that's why I say in the short run, all the talk will be about the technology. But in the long run, we're going to have lots of conversations around policy and legal issues. And my hope is that the people who start to make laws around AI are people who grew up with it, who have a deep understanding of what it really is and what it can really do. So we get laws that actually mean something versus laws that sound good in the abstract and that sound good as a slogan. But when you get right down to it, they're fairly easy for companies to circumvent, if you will. So I do think that's going to be one huge positive of AI going mainstream. Okay, so far so good. So I think you've convinced me that I think that this idea of sprinkling AI everywhere, it's not all bad. There's some good to it, right?
Some good to it. Some bad, but some good to it.
Okay, well, you say some bad. I mean, I you know me, I have opinions. We can put those in air quotes here. But what's your take on some of the bad of this idea of AI just being sprinkled everywhere? What, to use everyone's favorite phrase, what could possibly go wrong?
I remember an analogy where people refer to handing keys to a Porsche to like an 8-year-old. Like, would you hand car keys to a genius? And in theory, that person would know how to drive a car. In theory, but would you trust them without the right training? Would you trust them even though they don't have a license to do that? And I'm not saying that AI should be, everyone should have a license to use AI. I'm not saying that. But I think it's a little bit like watching that happen. Like, it's such a powerful tool. It's so great. Everyone has access to this powerful tool. That's great. However, not everyone knows how to use it to its full extent, or not everyone knows how to use it properly, right? Like, and that's fine for what you need for some cases, but it's, I would just caution, like, how much people will depend on the answers that they get out of it. I mean, I've seen this, you know, firsthand with companies who use data science or AI tools. They're like, oh, I could just, all I need to, like, I don't need to hire a data scientist. All I need to do, big air quotes here, all I need to do is just use this program or use this library that is so easy to install. I'll just feed it some data and get whatever the model results are out of it. And when they do that, they have a model, but it's not great, because they don't know what they're doing with it. You know, it's able to get them better than they might have been without the tool entirely, but it doesn't substitute necessarily for having the expertise that they really were asking for. At what point is it going to be, are people going to reach that pain point in using it, that they actually need it to have reliable results, but they don't know enough how to use it?
Okay, that paints an interesting picture then, because when I think about one of the problems we face with this idea of AI everywhere, sprinkling AI everywhere sort of thing, I immediately think about some of the privacy aspects that arise from this, right? Because to your point, this reminds me of when every company had to become a software company back about 10 to 15 years ago. And now every company is becoming a data company. And what that means is that companies are finding ways to use data, whatever way they can sort out, and that usually falls into some sort of marketing or advertising or something that involves them collecting and harvesting and analyzing and reselling personal data and that sort of thing. And so to your point that some of these companies are using tools that are spinning out random numbers or as good as random numbers, I wonder which is worse, when these companies that are engaging in this fairly invasive data collection, is it worse when they succeed because they hire the right people who analyze the data and get the results they need? Or is it worse when they use tools that provide them nonsense answers? And so they've collected all of this data and it's going nowhere. Like, which is worse in your eyes? Or do you think this is a case of there is no right answer?
Gosh, I don't want either of those.
You know, to my point about playing devil's advocate, is it so bad? And going back to your amazing talk from Data Council a few weeks ago, And you were talking about, you know, not just sprinkling AI on things. And again, I'm going to put words in your mouth, so correct me if I've gotten this wrong, but it sounds like what you're saying is also what I'm thinking, which is sprinkling data on things at random isn't necessarily bad, right? It sounds like what we're saying is that sprinkle AI on it is an extreme case of let's try AI and see where it fits. And if that's the case, it sounds like we don't so much need companies to stop trying AI. We just need them to start trying AI, I guess, in a little more focused fashion, one that's a little better for their budgets and team morale and that sort of thing. So before we continue, first, I'd like to see whether I'm just projecting or whether that's also what you're thinking.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking around what it means to sprinkle AI. So obviously there's a lot of annoyance with the attitude of, oh, you can just sprinkle some AI on it. But ultimately, adding AI to your products isn't what I'm saying that you shouldn't do. I'm saying if you want to add AI onto it, you can't just sprinkle it on. Instead of sprinkling it on, be deliberate about how you're using it, why you're using it. Plan for actually doing it. Don't just sprinkling it on at the end. And if you want to add it, it involves talking to people early. It involves doing this, making it baked into your process, making it part of the fundamental things that you're going to take care of first, because adding it on at the end, sprinkling it on later, adding things haphazardly, doesn't work for almost anything when it comes to building products, but especially for AI and for things that are involved with data.
My general view when it comes to all things AI, you know, especially as far as the executive data literacy side of AI, is that everything we do in AI is an experiment, right? No matter how much we want the model to work the way we want, no matter how much we would like the model to predict something very well, we don't always know that in advance. And so the guidance I give to my clients, and quite frankly, even any prospect that speaks with me about a predictive modeling exercise, is treat it like an experiment. And what that means is you want to be very mindful of how you invest your time and effort and money, because this is an investment. You're going to put some money and time and effort in because you want something greater to come out. And so that means try to design your experiments in a way that, step one, that you acknowledge their experiments, which means you sort of set the tone inside the company that this may not work out. Therefore, please don't broadcast everything to the public until we actually know it works. Step one. And then be mindful of how you structure this. You know, something I've stolen from the software development world is this idea of doing sprints for AI modeling. So build a model, try a few techniques. At the end of the sprint, check the results. Do you like the info coming back from the metrics? If so, great, move forward. And if not, at some point you have to ask yourself, how many more sprints are we really going to pay for? How much more time are we going to invest in this? And at some point you just have to pull the plug. I know a couple of my friends who, like me, used to work or still work in the financial space, they hear this and they're nodding their head thinking, well, of course, that's what we do every time we deploy a model to the markets for algorithmic trading. But I realize a lot of firms, they haven't come from that financial world. They haven't seen this. So yes, a free lesson from the world of electronic or algorithmic trading is structure this. Don't give it too much money at first. Give it a chance to prove itself out. And quite frankly, you're in this to make money. So if you've developed some sort of AI project or product, and after some predefined time, it's not returning anything of that investment, you really have to have a hard sit down and decide it's time to pull the plug. I think that's the big thing for me, is just adding structure to your experimentation so that it goes from being just sprinkling AI on it to acknowledging that we're trying something and that it might not work.
One of the things that I encourage my product managers to do is not only to have success metrics, but also to have failure metrics. How do you know you've succeeded is something that everybody always looks at. But then when you ask them, well, how do you know you've failed? And it's never the same metrics. It's never the same metrics. It's not, hey, the success metric, if it's zero, means we failed. It's, oh, if it's something entirely different, goes haywire, then we know we have failed. Like, well, are we tracking those things? And I think the same can be said for any decision making, like those milestones that you said. How do you know that you've succeeded? Great. How do you know that you know enough or have learned enough to go to the next step in any iterative process? But what's your exit criteria? Like, when do you know you shouldn't move on? It's not just, do you know that you should spend another cycle here? Or when do you know you should quit? When do you know it has, and failure is kind of a loaded term, right? But when do you know that you've learned enough from this experiment that it's the correct step not to continue further? It doesn't mean that you failed. You've learned a lot. You've learned how not to build whatever it was you're building. But when do you know when to stop? And that's just what I would add to that.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I think, okay, you know what? You're right. I used to use the term fail. I think it is a bit strong. I would say the experiment failed, but you did not. And I think Correct. That's an important distinction. Well, you're always going to learn something from an experiment. That's my science background coming into play. Sometimes what you learn is that our data will not let us predict customer churn. Okay, that's painful. You went into this hoping to predict customer churn, but now you know you're not going to, and you can stop throwing money at the experiment. Which takes me to, now that I think about it, my last thought for taking a more structured approach to this experimentation. So you're not just sprinkling AI on things. Is to think beyond the technical side of this. And I know this is a fairly technical podcast, and you and I have spoken a lot about the technical side of things. But when it comes to ML modeling, and again, I keep coming back to risk management on this, it's asking yourself about the model risk, right? What happens when the model is wrong? Are you going to deploy this model in a place where it's connected to automated purchasing decisions or anything else where if you let this machine run on its own, you can lose tons of money? You want to think about that early on and ask yourself, how wrong does this model have to be before we need human babysitters? Also, quite frankly, how wrong does it have to be during testing, where to your point, we say we've learned everything we're going to learn and we're just going to stop. The other side of that though, and some to your point about people don't think about failure metrics enough, when it comes to model risk, I don't think companies think nearly enough about what happens when the model is right. And what I mean is, it's one thing to build a model in a way that people find creepy because they find out the hard way that you've been harvesting your personal data. Fine. But it's even worse when the model is right, because you'll put it out in the public and people will say, oh, hey, this thing knows a lot more about me than I have ever expressly told you. That's a PR nightmare waiting to happen. So point being, think about when the model is wrong, sure, but also think about what happens when the model is right, because the model being right sometimes means you're in a much worse place than you'd expected.
Don't underestimate the power of your accurate modeling.
Exactly. So I do want to be mindful of your schedule. You've been very generous to share some time with me and the listeners today. I guess two quick ones for you. One, do you have any additional thoughts as far as adding structure to this experimentation so we're just not sprinkling AI on things? Any other advice you would give to companies on that topic?
Make sure that you do it. That I do that structured iteration, experimentation, collaboration early. Make a plan to do it as early as you can from the inception of your product all the way through the release. It's so important to have that collaboration and those feedback loops. And it's not siloed to just one part of that journey and one part of that build process. It should be throughout.
I like that. I think that's a great spot to wrap up. And so the last question I have for you, it's one I promised earlier in our discussion. So like you mentioned, while you were introducing yourself, you went from a couple of math degrees to data science into data product. And I would suspect that over the last however long we've been talking, some of our listeners have said, you know what, Noel's job sounds really cool. I'm a practicing data scientist right now. I would love to move into product. What other thoughts or guidance or tips do you think you could offer to a practitioner data scientist who is an aspiring data product person? And that can be both things that you think that they could do, things that they probably want to avoid, things that you did where you realize in retrospect, maybe I would have done it differently. What would you say?
Whenever anybody asks me about changing their careers or making a really drastic path change, I tell them to augment their current data set, get something a little bit closer rather than just making a crazy leap. I don't want to encourage people to say like, oh, all you need to do, quote unquote, is take a boot camp and learn how to be a PM in a few weeks and ta-da, you're a PM or a data scientist or whatever it is. the way that I would do that is build upon the skill sets that you already have to get incrementally closer, but also speak to your strengths. So if somebody is a data scientist and they say, I really want to get into product, ask yourself if what you're doing is product analytics. Are you working with product data day in and day out? Are your stakeholders, product managers, the product marketers, are you already entrenched in that, like the job that you think you want? Are you working with those people already? Do you have relationships with those people day in and day out? Do you have empathy for the problems that they're trying to solve? And are you solving them already? So that gets you incrementally closer. And it also, and then from there, you learn so much by osmosis. You learn so much by collaborating with those people. And I think a lot of people tend to be pretty generous with their insights if you just ask. So if you are working with product managers and you as a data scientist want to become one, talk to them, right? Work with the people. Like if you have the context of your product and your data, that already gives you a basis of knowledge to expand the skill sets that you're trying to work on. It is much harder to go at it cold. It's much harder. But if you have those already, it helps you expand and practice those skills that you don't have yet. You know, I could list a bunch of books. There's books everywhere that you could do and courses that you can do. But for me, I learn best by doing and from people as well. And so the more you can find those people in your organizations, the more that you can attach yourself to projects that are more producty and less researchy, as an example, could be one as well. Right. And so if you have any say or leeway, and even if you want to be transparent with your manager to say, like, I'm really interested in projects that look like this because I want to expand my skill set. Like, that's a conversation that you should have with your leadership who should be interested in your personal growth. So there are tons of opportunities, I think, in every organization to learn an adjacent skill set, to learn an adjacent role. And that's the best place that you should start.
Last one here. I suspect by now everyone listening to this podcast would love to catch up with you, chat with you, connect with you. Where do people find you?
I think the best way to find me these days, find me on LinkedIn. My name is pretty unique, Tuple. So all you got to do is look for Noel Saldana on LinkedIn and send me a note. I'd be happy to chat, make some new connections and chat all the things about sprinkling AI or data science or bad math jokes. I've got that aplenty if anybody wants to talk about that as well.
That's great. So we'll leave a link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes, as well as a link to your Data Council talk from a few weeks ago. So Noel, first of all, thank you once again for spending some time chatting with me today. And also, like I mentioned earlier, thanks again for all of your wonderful feedback on the blog post I was writing earlier. It's always fun when you have the same idea as a friend at the same time, and you're able to swap notes that way. So thank you very much.
Totally. It was really great working with you.